Hello and welcome to another episode of Is This Just Fantasy? I'm your host, Geordie Bailey.
And I'm his bastard of an offspring, Duncan Nicol.
It's nice that we're getting closer and closer with each podcast recording, Duncan. Now I'm a family member, whereas previously I have either been a good friend who will ultimately betray you, or I think a horse?
Oh yes, Green Rider, you are the horse.
Is This Just Fantasy? We are a podcast where every other week, Duncan and I, we get together and we discuss a fantasy novel which we've read in the past 2 weeks.
That we do, Geordie, and this week, it's your pick. We've got Assassin's Apprentice by Robin Hobb.
Yeah, this is the 50th fantasy novel we've read on this podcast. A little round of applause there. Hooray.
Yay.
And I really wanted to hit on a big fantasy touchstone. This is one I hear talked about a lot, about how influential it is and how good it is. So I really wanted to make sure that the last one we hit before that special number, well, it was a significant book.
I think that's fair, and this certainly is a significant book, Geordie. Like, not only this book kickstarted a series that is still running to this day. I think it's, 12 books strong?
Something like that.
Spin-off series, 15 in the universe? I'm not even sure. But Robin Hobb kicked it all off way back in 1995. So this is pre-Game of Thrones. Mm. Post-Wheel of Time, I think that had already kicked off. We'd had our Dark Tower, but still mid-90s. This is a good time for fantasy. This is epic fantasy was coming out.
And I'm desperate to hear what you thought of it, Duncan. But before we do so, have you been reading anything else these past 2 weeks?
Oh, that I have, Geordie. I've actually read quite a bit. As you know, I took a little holiday, to a little sabbatical, and was away, the new Avatar TV show came out.
It sure did. Geordie. And I have actually heard surprisingly little about it. I don't really know whether it was well received or not.
So, Avatar The Last Airbender, originally an animated TV show, has been brought to live action adaptation by Netflix, similar to the vein to how they did One Piece and Cowboy Bebop. And it's okay. It's very middle ground, Geordie. At least I found it that way.
Okay.
So, when I first started watching, I watched the first episode and I went, that was different and probably worse.
All right.
And I'll tell you the tale, Geordie. I watched the first episode, it's an hour long.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went, okay, I'm going to go and rewatch the first episode of the TV show.
Sure.
And I ended up watching the first two episodes just because that covers the same continent, the same time frames. So it's more comparable.
Mm.
And I kind of just sat there and went, okay, the animated version that I just watched was better. It just was. And I'm going to say this now, having finished the whole series, yes, the animated version is better.
Right.
It's the better version of the story. If you're going to pick one, pick that one. But the live action was still good enough. It was definitely something where I basically sat down and went, well, why don't I just rewatch the animated version? And I just kind of went, well, Duncan, you've already seen it. Like, you know it's great, and you just know that it cannot possibly bring anything new into your life at this point. Like, you've watched it several times,
uh-huh,
all the way through. It's done. Like, and I just kind of went to myself, well, I'd rather watch something that maybe, almost certainly is, an inferior product. But at least it's different. Like, it'd be worth seeing a different take.
Duncan,
even if
it might
it's maybe
be,
not the definitive version.
You know what also is different, but might be just as good as Avatar, is watching a different TV show.
Okay, yeah, that is a very strong counter-argument.
I didn't mean for that to sound as mean as it was, but, like, what's the point, right?
That I am struggling to argue. I think it's because when you see something that you're familiar with from a different perspective, you can then maybe get a different level of kind of value out of the original. I see the original slightly differently now because I've seen an alternative take. And also, it's still high fantasy. The action's still quite fun. And the bloke playing Iroh is still really good.
Well, that's lovely. I mean, I don't have any interest in watching it myself. I'm pretty sick of remakes. I was astounded by how much I enjoyed the One Piece remake. But the thing I liked most about that was how much it crams down the very long East Blue arc into just one season.
I think that's definitely one benefit. And almost this kind of shame in the Avatar one, where it's taking what was originally, I think it was originally 10 hours, and it's cut it all the way down to 8 hours.
Mm.
You're like, well, that wasn't really a feather in your cap. And it kind of makes me think of, like, the Cowboy Bebop one, where I was like, I'm just happy to see more Cowboy Bebop. Again, Geordie, I would say this. If you've not seen any, see the animated version. Like, it's okay to non-offensive, and I think that might line up with what you're hearing about it, which is kind of nothing.
Mm.
it's all right, and it might get better. And you're right, though. If I was going to spend 8 hours watching a TV show, there is a laundry list of probably better shows and better fantasy shows at that that I probably should have spent my time doing. But what I did spend my time doing is, because I was with Avatar The Last Airbender, I went back and read one of the comics.
Okay.
You familiar with the Avatar comics?
I've never read any of them. I'm kind of aware of what they do. There was a couple. They were on the bookshelf at a comic book store recently because of a new TV show. All I know is that it lets you find out what happened to Zuko's mum, but I don't know what happened to Zuko's mum. Is she evil? I think she's evil.
I'm not going to spoil that one for you, Geordie. But yes, the Avatar, The Last Airbender, it has a couple of comics that continue the story post the TV show. And instead of coming out like weekly issues, it's done in graphic novel trilogies. By and large, so you get 3 trade paperbacks to kind of create an arc, and then you refer to that arc as a whole. So they all have the different names. You have The Search, Zuko's Mother, The Promise, which deals with Zuko's position and a great kind of insight into colonialism. That's a really good one. It kind of like, what do you do when the Fire Nation is pulling out of the Earth Kingdom, which they invaded in the TV show, and some of the people are like, well, actually, we kind of like the new management. It wasn't all bad. So that was a really interesting topic. The one I read was called Imbalance, and I actually really enjoyed it, and I do recommend these comics. They do tackle different issues, like social issues, that maybe weren't addressed in the wider TV show. And it's nice to see those characters and that kind of Avatar take on these issues, where there is a level of more complexity, but it doesn't necessarily get too dark and gritty with it. Mm. So the one I read called Imbalance, it goes back to the issue that's looked at in the first season of the sequel TV show Korra, Legend of Korra, which is the balance of power between benders, which are the magic users, and the non-benders. And dear God, Geordie, I had massive Children of Blood and Bone vibes. Because it's like, well, what do you do? How can you have an equal society where you can have an earthbender who can, you know, manipulate stone? Well, they can build you a house in like under 2 minutes, and it means nothing to them. Why would any normal person bother learn to be a bricklayer?
Well, Duncan, the answer to that is that you reveal that the main instigator of this social change is actually just an evil bad guy, and that therefore the cause is completely invalid and you ignore it for the rest of the series.
That's why I thought Imbalance was very interesting compared to Korra, because in Imbalance, it's the benders, the magic users. It's really hard when they use that term for a British person, but anyway, are shown as being the bad guys. So it's the idea that they are attacking the factories, because the factories and the Industrial Revolution is taking away their sort of naturally perceived superiority in society. And so our main characters, who are all magic users, are having to kind of work this line where the non-benders are like, well, you don't represent us. But they're like, yeah, but we think we need to help you regardless. And it's really nicely done. Probably could have been so much more in depth, but I'm at least happy it was kind of touched upon. So do seek out the comics if you're a fan of the TV show. The first 2 arcs, The Search and The Promise, are a must. Mm-hmm. And then I think they do gradually taper off in quality post then. But still, all of the ones that I've read up to the end of Imbalance, well worth it.
Are these continuous releases? Are these still coming out? Or is it sort of something that's been and gone?
They're still coming out. So they're very sporadic. It's very much we get a new one, because they can go straight to trade paperbacks. It's like one comes out every like 2 years.
Mm.
We'll get like a new story arc. What we're getting at the moment, where I mentioned before they were graphic novel trilogies, now we're getting more single shot, single trade paperback stories. And whereas before they've always been this like continuing the timeline. So we're like 5 years out from the TV show now. The newest ones that have come out have all actually been kind of set during the TV show. So we've had like, there's one called like Suki Alone. Suki is a character in the TV show who has a time where she's out of like a season and a half because she's in prison. And it just kind of goes back over that story. Or there's another one which is like Katara and the Silver Pirates. And it's just sort of a fit in the timeline. Here's a little extra story. It's like a missing episode almost. But Geordie, what about you? If you've not been on the Avatar train.
Not been on the Avatar train. I've been on the sci-fi train. I've scarcely touched any fantasy that I was not contractually obliged to read. Instead, it has been... So, I saw Dune in a movie theater, and I liked it a lot. I really liked Dune Part 2. I appreciated all the changes. I think it's a really good example of making smart adaptational changes, which a lay audience is not going to get about what is quite a weird book series. And that got me into a old school spaceship kind of mood. Which meant that
So just the record, I haven't seen Dune yet, and I'm so excited.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah, you should see it, man. It's really good.
I am seeing it. That's not, like, that's the idea of me not going to cinema to see it. It's just like, there's not been a film where I've gone, this is going to be that sci-fi fantasy epic that I haven't, like, felt since, I don't know, Return of the King?
Last night, my girlfriend and I, we had a Dune-themed party. Only three people, but still. And we served the Water of Life as a cocktail. To make the Water of Life cocktail is to pour in one part vodka, two parts blue Gatorade, one part lemonade, and a sprinkling of cinnamon. It's disgusting, and I don't recommend it to anyone, but I did snag some photos of it for the Instagram.
Well, that's great to hear, and a great thing to plug the Instagram, people. If you're listening to this, go over, follow us on Instagram. You get not only updates when a new episode releases, but you also get little tidbits of all the other things we're reading and checking out in between. So head over there.
And what I've also been enjoying, because I got into that spacey mood, after 3 years of trying and trying, I finally finished and even learned to enjoy Foundation by Isaac Asimov. And I want you to understand, listeners, when I say I finally finished Foundation, I don't mean I finished the Foundation series. It took me 3 years to read Foundation by Isaac Asimov because I really bounced off it like 4 times, but I finally finished it. And then, because I finally learned to enjoy it, I immediately read iRobot cover to cover. And then I've started Foundation and Empire.
Okay, a couple of things here. Firstly, I'm really happy for you. Secondly, I can't believe you bounced off it. People always talk about Isaac Asimov being like really hard to penetrate or really dry. I never got that. I always find him quite a, you know, quick, whip-roaring read because he is, for the most part, quite short and to the point.
I can't quite agree with that. It's very understandable, in my opinion, to bounce off it because whilst it is essentially a series of short stories, the short stories are all about people taking in action. The whole point of a series is don't do anything, stay the course, don't make any sudden changes. And also, I've been counting, and so far, in the past 2 books of his I've read, there have been 4 women, and 3 of them are horrible, and the other one likes pretty dresses.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to defend that. That is definitely the case and is an issue.
But otherwise, enjoying it. I did remember Dr. Susan Calvin being an interesting character when I was a kid and someone I look back on very fondly. But boy, howdy. She's crazy. She's a horrible shrew. And the moment she's alone with a robot, she starts complaining about how she can't get a man.
She's in several stories. I do think some of the other ones that are in The Complete Robot, which is the expanded works of the robot stories, maybe do in a slightly better life. Life? Light? So, there is that. But, no, I quite agree. And it's really interesting. I do recommend to anyone out there to try Foundation. Do you feel that maybe if you'd done iRobot first, you would have found it maybe an easier in? Because that's where I started.
I did read iRobot first. I read iRobot when I was 12 or 13.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense. You said you read about Susan Calvin. And would you recommend that to people? Go for iRobot first.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good.
Oh, yeah. On the same page there. Good series of books. It's basically a series of, like, puzzles, which is also true for Foundation, but Foundation is deliberately obtuse.
Not going to argue with that one either. I think what I'd like about both those series, though, is that they do, all of them start off quite brief. And one of the things that kind of actually turns me off is that once you get past the third Foundation book and the third sort of book in the robot series, they all of a sudden like double or like triple in size. That's not my style. I like a book to be short to the point.
Anyway, I've been off in space enjoying the robots and the hyperdrives and the atomic blasters, but none of that today. We are staying clear of space, clear of anything remotely sci-fi. We are reading The Assassin's Apprentice by Robin Hobb.
Oh, that we are, Geordie. Geordie, so this is a completely new read for you.
That's right. Never read this before. My only experience of it was playing one Dungeons & Dragons game where one person was determined to play Fitzchivalry Farseer, down to even having being raised by a guy called Burich and having weird relationships with his father and grandfather, which he was so precise about when we were like teenagers playing this, that I was deeply confused by why he needed to be so specific about these different elements. But now I understand!
Oh, gosh. Jordy, what's your opinion on people like just taking literature characters for the D&D character? As a general rule.
If you're playing for the first time, go ahead, do it, whatever it takes to get you involved in the game and to get you thinking about it. But it's something that a game master should start to push against you. Like, for example, I've had someone who really wants to play Aragorn, basically, literally wants to play Aragorn. They named their character Strider. And as the game went on, I sort of pushed this person to be like, okay, so what do you think you're going to do in this situation? Deliberately trying to make them think about whether they wanted to do something or whether the artifice they created around their character by saying he wanted him to be Aragorn, he actually wanted, you know, to maintain. And normally people break away and they start to come up with their own ideas. And because they're their own ideas, they're actually more invested in them. So yeah, I don't encourage it. And I try to maneuver people away from it.
I think that's a healthy outlook. I always find that if you always spend too much to what you think your character should do, then inevitably you end up playing a game where you end up almost hating your character. You're like, oh, he's put me in this situation. I just don't like it.
Yeah, it's like, I remember you had a character in a D&D campaign once called Nanok. And if you write Nanok backwards, you get Conan. And you wanted a character who was kind of inspired by Conan. But as time went on, like, Nanok was very much his own character and did stuff that was unique to him.
Yeah, and you need to keep that kind of connection going. And also then to feel the weight of the responsibility. So we're going way off onto D&D here. So that's excellent. So you're fresh-faced. I'm not fresh-faced when it comes to Robin Hood's work. And I've had a bit of a difficult past. So I read Assassin's Apprentice. I read it in sort of my early 20s as part of my explosion into wider fantasy. You know, when I went out and I got the laundry list of all the top 25 fantasy books ever written all at once and went, right, I'm going to read through these. And I read Assassin's Apprentice and I liked it. And then I went immediately into Royal Assassin, the sequel. And Geordie, I'm not sure what happened, but I didn't finish it. I bounced off. I sort of went, oh, I'm not sure, I'm not vibing, I'm not feeling it, and I don't know what it was. I don't know if it was that book, I don't know if it was fatigue. I'm not going to, I mentioned earlier about Foundation and like Edge of Foundation being like a much thicker book. Maybe it's the fact that Royal Assassin was suddenly a lot larger. It does bother me. I don't know if you ever have this. Like, do you like all the books in a series to be roughly the same length? Was that me thing?
Oh, not really. I do appreciate that bloat happens, you know, as writers go on. I don't know. Sometimes it does bother me. I think that, for example, The Order of the Phoenix is way too long. Like, it does not need to be that long. There isn't enough stuff in their book to justify its length. So yeah, I guess there are some series where I don't like how swollen they get by the end. But for the most part, I kind of just want to let authors do what authors do. One of the things I love about Christopher Paolini is how he just writes what he wants to write about. But we both had problems with the length in Murtagh.
Maybe it's that extra element of like when I pick up a book, I like, it's like starting a movie. Have you ever sat there and you've gone, right, what are we going to watch this evening, darling? She goes, oh, well, we could watch this. I'm like, oh yeah, but it's 2.5 hours. You know, don't we want to get to bed? Let's find something that's only 1.5 hours. And then by the time you find that movie, it's been 1 hour and you could have watched the first one. Like, I like that kind of consistency. I like to know what I'm getting in for, but
I've never experienced anything like that, darling. Okay. I'm sorry. I know you want my support in this.
Fair enough. That's a me thing. So I bounced off it, and I think part of bouncing off Royal Assassin meant that my kind of opinion on the series, I only read 1.5, and Assassin's Apprentice, then got a little bit coloured. And I think I've carried this throughout the years. I've not really thought about Assassin's Apprentice as being one of the ones really up there. And this revisit, Geordie, and here's the big reveal, showed me how awfully wrong I was and how I thought this book was not only really fun to read, but how actually, despite the fact that I was revisiting this one book in the series that I didn't like super love, I found myself really emotionally engaging with this book. Like, I felt the love and the pain of these characters immensely on this second read. And gosh, it really took me by surprise.
I think emotional engagement is really important for this particular book. The thing that really sets it apart from a lot of fantasy And maybe I'm reading into the experiences of other people too much, but in my understanding, the level of like emotional complexity you'll have for the character of Fitz was pretty unique. Maybe not unique, but it was kind of out of the blue at the time of its release. Some people call this book misery porn, and I understand why people would call it that, because you spend a lot of your time watching a poor child being emotionally abused throughout a good portion of the book, and it's a book that reckons with that. It doesn't just throw him into bad situations and then let him get through it, and that's that. You see the impact it leaves on him.
And that's certainly an opinion which I think I did hold walking away from this book for so long. I'm not going to lie, that angle does continue into the sequel and is a factor to why I think I ultimately was like, I don't know if I'm enjoying this sufficiently, but particularly revisiting this first book with sort of the knowledge that he comes through okay, like I thought he was going to die in book one of a 12-book series, kind of made me a little bit more like robust to it and also able to analyse what he was going through. Instead of being a little bit too wrapped up with the character, I could actually stand back and look at him and, oh God, this is a person who's going through these emotions and this is how he's handling it. And maybe also my own maturity since first reading this series makes me go, okay, well, what's healthy? What's good for him? Okay, what are the harmful things in his way? What is he doing? What's the right thing? And having that kind of evaluation is what really kind of drew me that bit closer this time around.
My experience of reading this book is that it has a certain lackadaisical approach to the course of the world and his life. It sort of dum-de-dum-de-dum takes you through from him at the age of 6 to the age of 15. And you see a lot of the experiences that shape him through this place. It doesn't really jump around over huge amounts of time. You know, he arrives at this palace, he's the bastard son of the firstborn prince, and then he gets raised by the servants and he's gradually brought up in his station. But you see him from being a stable boy to being like a promising young man to being an assassin's apprentice. Then you see him doing his psychic training and then becoming an assassin, and all of these steps are gone through in detail. And I think the devil is in that detail, because some people are going to love that and some people are going to hate that and find it really boring. One of my notes for this book said, it's a good thing Robin Hobb is a great writer because this book should be really dull.
Oh, do I agree with that statement? I certainly agree with the fact that a lot of the events that I remembered from this book, those like key events were maybe a fourth of the total page count.
Sure.
That, like, in terms of like, yeah, that's a thing that happened. A lot of the rest of it is these interactions, interacting with his different tutors. In fact, that's the main thing is, you know, interacting with Beric, which we've mentioned is the stable master, and getting lessons from Galen, who's the psychic teacher, magic teacher, is all about him interacting with these different tutors. And
yeah, and even unofficial teachers, but people who still teach him things, like Patience, who is not a literal tutor, but she is teaching him like to be a young gentleman. That's like his lesson. And it's also a rare experience of like actual compassion from someone who would love to be compassionate and is wonderfully complicated because she's not actually able to provide the motherly affection she wants to.
Even another character of Molly, who is the street urchin friend he meets and who works in the candle shop down in the town, in many respects is there to teach him. You know, she's teaching him about not only what, you know, the experiences of young love, but also teaching him about like what life is like when you're not up in the castle, what other people put up day to day.
Yeah,
like,
sure.
That is the relationship he has with most characters.
In comparison, the big matters of court and state are really surprisingly distant. Considering that he's the son of a crown prince and he lives in the castle and he has occasional conversations with the king, King Shrewd, big events in the kingdom are kind of really small and distant. Like, the death of his father is handled so suddenly and so briefly that sometimes I forgot it had happened. It's like, oh, he died. Fell off a horse. He died. That's it. We're not going to go into any detail about it.
What really gets me about that detail, Geordie, oh gosh, am I minor spoilers here? It's not spoilers because I don't know about this because I haven't read the books. But I spoke to a friend who had read all the books. I'm like, gosh, should we really go in? Like, what happened there? What, like, mechanisms? And he actually turned to me and went, they don't ever really go into that. Like, that's just not a focus. It's just not what it's about.
Yeah, and it's not about that. That's the thing, is that the affairs of state, it's not about what's happening to the kingdom. It's about this guy's memoirs. It's all written in the past tense first person of Fitz writing the story of his life. And because he was 6 years old at the time that happened, he brushes over it because he doesn't really remember anything about it. And he doesn't write about something he doesn't know. He doesn't know whether it was true or not. And then stuff like the forgers, you know, what are they called? The forgings, the forgers.
Oh, that's a good question. What do they call it? The red ships, the raiders, they forge people.
No, I'm talking about the forgers, the things that they create.
The forged.
The forged, yes, thank you, Duncan. I couldn't remember the exact nomenclature. Like, the forged are explored in detail to begin with in his direct, like, interactions with them. But once they're a part of the established world, he doesn't really mention them. Presumably because the story we're reading is a document, which you're supposed to have just found in the world. You found this guy's autobiography. And of course, you already know what a forged is. So he doesn't need to go into detail about, oh yes, and then they proliferated throughout the kingdom, and they turned up here, there, and everywhere. It just assumes you kind of know what they are, and it doesn't bother to go into detail.
There's a lot about the wider world building, which, whilst kind of subtly laid down, we do not get a lot of in-depth. Like, we don't see much of the world outside the capital city, and even that, we don't really see outside the keep. So I couldn't tell you what society's like in, well, the kingdom's called the Six Duchies. What culturally they represent, parallels to our world. Are they all kind of medieval Europe? Do other parts of it have kind of oriental aspects? I don't know. I don't know what their like culture is like.
And it was a very surprising towards the very end of the book when they go to the other kingdom, and it's quite different. Like, they live in buildings that are made out of warped trees that have been specially molded in, and it was such a strange departure from what felt like a pretty standard medieval Europe kind of setting that it felt suitably fantastical.
So, Geordie, a lot of elements there, quite a lot of praise. Is there a particular moment that you're like, this is the part where I knew I loved this book? Like, this is the thing that will stick with me?
Well, Duncan, to be honest, I don't know that I do love the book.
Oh, okay.
I like it. I don't know if I love it. Like, there's a lot of stuff in here I enjoy, but at the end of the day, there's a reason I said this book should be boring. Because it is a little bit boring. Like, I don't actually care that much about hearing about Fitz sweeping the stables. Robin Hobb does a good job of it because she finds ways to make it, like, you know, it doesn't feel turgid, but it's still not interesting.
Interesting to hear your opinion, because I didn't have that vibe. For me, what I always thought you would go, be like, oh yeah, it was this scene with Beric, it'd be this scene with Nosy. Because for me, I was like, it was when like Patience got introduced that I was like, oh, this is such a unique character dynamic, like relationship. Oh, I love this. I want to come back to experience more of this.
Yeah, and interactions and the characters are really a strong suit. It's so true that like characters like Boric and Chade and Lady Patience are really great characters because they are so nuanced and unique. Like, Boric is a character who you want to like, but you keep being frustrated with because he's not actually a good paternal figure for Fitz. And then you encounter Patience, and you're like, oh, well, this is a character who could show him a lot of his very much needed maternal affection, but she's not good at it. And then Chade shows up, and he seems really promising as a teacher, and then he emotionally abuses Fitz for a bit. And it's very complicated, because you still like these characters, even though they let you down.
It's really interesting, and I think that is part of that. You say mystery porn, it's like, I feel constantly sorry for Fitz, because he deserves a better break than he's ever given. And he always does so well for what he goes through. And there's a particular part in this book which I do think is the bit where I was like, okay, this is now too uncomfortable for me to an extent. Like, you know, I read through it. But you're right, going back to the character of Beric, you know, you look at this, like, this is meant to be your kind of key fatherly figure. And it's hard because Fisk goes, oh, he didn't beat me. Or he, you know, and you're like,
yep.
And you're like, that's good. That's the bare minimum. Maybe a little less than that.
But he also scars him emotionally by making sure that he will always feel completely alone for the rest of his life. We haven't gone much into the core details of the book, and we haven't even mentioned the word skill yet, but the chief magic in the book is called the skill, and it's psychic powers. You know, you can read into people's emotions, you can send messages at long distance, you can control them, blah blah blah. Fitz has the skill. He inherited it from his father, but he has something more than the skill. He has a more powerful version of it, which allows him to psychically connect not only with humans, but with animals as well. It's called the wit. And Burch, when he discovers that he has this power, he emotionally blackmails him into not using it because he thinks that it's debasing, it's evil, and he shouldn't do it. He is making himself less than a man. And he separates him from his puppy, who he has formed a psychic bond with, and he goes from having the experience of never truly being alone, because he's able to share the thoughts of this creature which loves him dearly, to then suddenly being one soul by himself forever.
Well, when you put it like that, Beric seems like quite the irredeemable bastard.
And then he beats up Fitz's bully and you like him again.
It's complex. That particular first thing, then, with the wit, I do want to zero back in on that, because, Geordie, I'm assuming the Robin Hood is inviting us to sort of place on top of that a number of other ways of real world kind of connotations there. One thing is, like, well, if you've got a young child, it's like, hide who you truly are. You know, I think of, like, you know, having to masking is a common phrase. You know, if you're neurotypical, don't react like that.
Sure.
Obviously, yeah. I think if the character was a bit older, very obvious one to put on, like, you know, homosexual connotations and being gay and being like, nope, that's debasing, that's shameful. Don't you dare do it in my house. Oh, don't worry, I'm just trying to help you.
That's a good comparison. I think that Fitz is a character who a lot of, like, 15-year-olds would connect with. I think that because it's a book about someone coming into their identity and dealing with a lot of really dark thoughts and feelings of loneliness, I think that if you read this at a certain age, it's probably like catnip. It's probably really magnetic to attach yourself to a character like this and put yourself in his shoes and relate to him. But I'm not at that stage in life, and to a certain extent, moments like that where it gets really dark and depressing and stuff like that, they don't really engage me as much.
I mean, that's fair enough, and certainly I think I can see how that would appeal, the fact that so many characters in this book basically form that student-teacher relationship. Like, that's going to ring true with kids more than adults. Like, that mentorship is what you predominantly experience up to a certain age. Weirdly, then, maybe it's why I'm a little bit more flipped now that I'm getting older, and now I'm starting to look more at, like, patience and looking at her as a character and going, wow, I really feel what you're trying to do and your struggles almost so much more. And that's when it's really resonating, is when I look at one of the adult characters.
What I enjoy a lot about the last part of a book, and I would probably score this book a lot lower if it weren't for the third act, when he actually goes in his first proper mission as an assassin, like, independent. And what I like about it so much is that it kind of reminds me of something like Dune, where it's mostly about characters thinking through their actions really carefully, and a bit where Fitz just has to think really hard about, what's the right course of action here? How am I being tricked? Who can I trust? And he starts going over what he's been told by different characters, and he logically thinks about, like, oh, well, I can tell this person's lying because this doesn't make sense. That was by far the most engaging part. And for that reason, I was really interested in reading Royal Assassin, the next one, because I'm like, if he just gets to go on missions and encounter situations like this again, I think I would find it really interesting.
I'm not going to say he doesn't, but it certainly doesn't switch hit a switch and go purely that route. Just from what I've read, and I did not finish the whole text, that there's still quite a bit more of back in Buckkeep, the main castle, doing that I'm a student, you're a teacher stuff. It's still definitely there, but I can certainly see how the series will build towards it. One of the things that I'm actually a bit surprised, like, I do really want to keep reading this series, Geordie, a lot more, because actually I realise how much not knowing the answer to some of this book's mysteries is kind of irksome to me. Like, it's been like 7 years. I don't know who these Red Ship raiders are.
Yeah. What are the Forged? I don't know. I want to know.
The Forged, I think, are such a cool idea, Geordie.
I think so too.
Like, talking about, going back to like D&D and like moral dilemmas you throw at a party. Be in that situation. If you pay the ransom. So the Red Ship Raiders, they take people from a town, smash up the place, arson, whatever, theft, and they kidnap people. And then they send a letter and they go, pay us a ransom or we will return the hostages to you.
And that seems like maybe a typo or something, but unfortunately, it's not.
It is not, because they return the people to them. But the people, when they come back, they are, how do you put it? They're like hollow. They're not their former selves. They're not zombies. They are, instead, it's like all their worst attributes is all that's left. All they can do is steal things, eat, and be violent.
Yeah, there's no compassion left. They're still rational. They can still think clearly. But it's like greed is their one guiding principle.
So, firstly, as a monster, amazing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Even if they were like more zombie-like, then I feel that there can be this level of, oh, you're pushing them out of their misery. Like, Tom's not really there anymore. Go on, hit them in the back of the head with a hammer. Look at the roses. But because they're like, they're rational still, you're like, well, is it still that person? What do I do? Can I bring them back around? No one knows. And that's a great bit in this book where you're like, can we fix them? Do we need to just kill them? And I love the fact that the kingdom, like the king never, it's brought up the fact that people just want a direction on what to do, and how the king's like, I don't know. Do we pay the ransom? Do we just kill them on sight? What do we do?
Yeah. Talking about the king leads on to is kind of a nice part of the book, and that is the names of characters. So there's a theme in the book where characters, noble characters, are mostly named after virtues or qualities someone can have. For example, Fitz is called Fitz Chivalry. One word, but both names capitalized for some reason. And his father was called Chivalry. And there's this special magical ritual which is supposed to take place where when you name someone, they are magically bound to keep that name and to embody it. It becomes fused to them. And it's just not true. It's just this great irony in the book that, like, anytime you see a character with a certain name, you're like, okay, so you probably aren't actually that virtue.
It just, for me, is a little bit like, so if this was genuinely true and wasn't just like smoke and mirrors for the aristocracy, why wouldn't everyone just be like, you are successful?
Yeah.
You succeed at whatever you try. Good luck, go away.
I named my child Best.
Well, also then you look to the king and you're like, okay, I understand in terms of his current position, he's shrewd because he's the shrewd king. But that means his dad went, not baby chivalrous, not baby forward planning, not baby glorious, baby shrewd.
I mean, people are called virtue names in real life, but we also don't actually think they're gonna live up to it, I think. Oh, that's depressing. I don't know why I said that. That's a horrible thing to say. I'm sorry to everyone out there who's named Verity or Felicity.
I don't know what to comment on that. I think virtue names is a very interesting route to go down. I put it alongside rock names. I don't get it. No, not to diss on anyone. I'm just like,
what do you mean by rock names? Garden Path? Cobble?
No. Things like Ruby, Sapphire, Emerald, Diamond.
I don't think I've ever met anyone called... Actually, no, I know numerous rubies. I forgot.
Again, personal preference. It's a lovely name. Enjoy it for yourself. It's just not where my brain first goes. But sorry, back to the book. Yeah, I don't know. I think that's a really cool... I like the idea, and I love the fact that one of the kind of villains of the piece is the youngest prince, Regal. Now, this is so interesting. Firstly, I love the fact that the idea is that his mum called him Regal. So he is the youngest prince by a different mother than his elder two brothers.
He's a half-brother to the other princes.
And the whole point of this is that his mum wants him to be king. And the argument is she's more royal than the previous queen. So, like, his total sum royalty should up him the chain.
Yeah.
And to be fair, Geordie, there is a little bit of, like, precedent for that thought, even in, like, British monarchy.
British monarchy is very nebulous. Like, the Norman Conquest is, like, a complete mess where four different people all kind of had rights to the throne and might have all had a good promise. And genuinely, the person who had the closest direct connection to Edward the Confessor was the least likely person to take the crown.
I think that's a fair way to put it. The Norman Conquest was a mess. It was a smash and grab.
Yeah.
I think the best one is actually the Henry Tudor, where you're like, you really shouldn't be here.
No, like, he's just some guy. He happened to stumble his way into the right position at the right time.
But so this goes back. So the idea I'm actually referring to is there was a bit. So the idea at the moment of like the firstborn takes the crown, or it used to be, you know, even just 30 years ago, the firstborn son takes the crown. There was one notion of being born in the purple, that the firstborn son, after the dad had already become king, took the crown.
Oh, well, that's stupid.
It was done once, and that was only because he wanted to murder his older brother.
Well, there we go. I knew it was just going to be a stupid excuse. Do you remember who it was?
Oh, God, you're testing my history here. I want to say it was Henry II.
Just tell me later and I'll edit it in. Duncan never actually told me who it was, but I looked it up myself, and it was Henry I. And I never liked that guy. I always thought he was a suspicious jerk. Yeah, my brother died on a hunting accident. Yeah, bloody right. What a dick. Hate that guy. Anyway, back to the episode.
But yeah, I love Fiegel as a villain, Geordie. Did you get the same, like, this guy's smarmy. So beautifully smarmy.
Yes, he's wonderfully smarmy. And his, him actually coming into becoming an obvious villain right at the end is handled really well in the way in which, like, his scheme is slowly unpacked and his lies are peeled away. It's not the sudden mask off moment. There's no evil maniacal laugh. It's just him very imperiously demanding that his will be done, and then slowly the main character being clever enough to see through it.
And what I really like about this, particularly this section where he's being really kind of like demanding on the main character, and the main character saying, well, he's still the prince, you know, what do I do, is this really nice element of even the main character, and as the reader, you're not 100% sure if the king isn't even slightly in on it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so opaque and he's kept so in the dark that he can't really be sure what the correct course of action is.
Geordie, this is one reason I really want to keep reading, because this character is set up so beautifully. Like, I just feel like his death / comeuppance could be nothing other than like the best, like, pathos moment. I so want every bit, even if it's just Verity giving him like a verbal slap down in front of the court, I'd be like,
which he doesn't
yes.
get in this book. Like, his dismissal is so coy and genteel, and it's quite aptly done, but it's you're right, there's no like karma moment. There's no him getting like, oh yeah, I feel good about him being taken down.
Who does get taken down in this book, though, is quite possibly the worst of all of Fritz's teachers.
Yes, Galen. Galen is the really odious character. He has all the worst elements of just being the petulant schoolyard bully and the worst teacher you ever had, combined with a bit of just straightforward evil psychic. And evil psychics are scary. Peeling into your head, looking inside your noggin. Not fun, not fair.
Definitely a little bit of that Severus Snape from Half-Blood Prince, I want to say. Or maybe it's Order of the Phoenix.
Order of the Phoenix.
Didn't even plan for that to come up again. Exactly, kind of intruding on a main character, which is awkward when you're a young teenager anyway. And this guy is such a wonderful arsehole. And he is constantly to Fitz, you shouldn't be here, You're the bastard son. You have no place in our society. You know, you're rising above your station. Get back down. What I really liked about Galen is the fact that it's kind of inferred that he was quite loyal and a fan of Fitz's father.
Well, I it's more than that, man. There's a scene where Fitz is speaking to Verity, and it's revealed that chivalry brainwashed him to worship him. So chivalry comes off pretty well in this book, despite siring a bastard. Like he wasn't even betrothed to his wife at the time. Like, he's basically not done anything wrong in having him, but he's still undermined by this thing because it affects the politics, blah, blah, blah. But there's this one moment where you go, oh man, chivalry seemed pretty good, and now I'm not so sure because he psychically made Galen think he's great.
And it's really kind of interesting. To be fair, Geordie, even in my own reading of that, I glossed over that when it comes to assessing chivalry. Like, I kind of read this book and still came up going, oh, wasn't chivalry just the best? Oh, it's such a shame what happened to him.
It's because you're supposed to. Everyone you talk to loves him. But you gotta wonder, does Boruch love chivalry so much and is so loyal to him because chivalry was great? Or was he poking around in Boruch's head as well?
Geordie, that thought had, like, never occurred to me, and I actually feel a little bit, like, sick on the inside, just considering that chivalry had been going around, like, psychically influencing, like, the whole kingdom.
Everyone seems to think he's great, that's all I'm saying.
Hopefully not patience.
I hope Verity doesn't let me down, because I left this book and I like Verity, and you're supposed to like him. It reminds me a lot of the King in Green Rider, where you're just supposed to think he's a swell guy.
He strikes me, obviously a bit odd coming back to Game of Thrones reference, strikes me a little bit of a Rob, not Rob. Gosh, what? How long has it been since I've read this book?
Rob Ert Baratheon?
No. The first, Eddard Stark. Ned Stark.
You forgot Ned?
Yeah, a little bit. He strikes me as quite straight-laced. Like, he's got his duty, and he's just gonna keep focus on it, even if it might get him into trouble down the line. That's how I see it. I see Verity as a little bit, like, not quite ready to take a step over to the dark side, if necessary.
My reading of it was is that the philosophical statement which the book has is that two good things you can do are to be true to something. So Fitz is heroic because he never breaks promises. If he makes a promise, he follows it through to the bitter end. He makes conflicting promises to Shrewd and to Chade, and his inability to betray Shrewd causes him so much emotional damage. But despite it all, he still manages to keep his words to the King, despite going through this turmoil, and he even manages to keep it to Chade because he follows through on the promise he made, even though, like, Chade made it void and said he didn't have to do it. But the other thing it valorizes is the idea of service to your people. I forget what it's called because it's only mentioned at the end of the book, but the other country they go to, the mountain people, you know, they are valorized because they are still a monarchy, but they're a lot more democratic. There is a sense that politicians serve their people as opposed to the other way around. And that's lionized.
Novel concept.
Yeah, and Verity, despite being a much more straightforward monarch in that he's a crown prince and he serves a much more normal monarchy, he also believes in service. You know, he refuses to go to this special ceremony because he has to stay his post and he has to watch out for the Red Ship Raiders and he has to do his duty.
I really like it that even his father, Shrewd, tells Verity, no, go to your wedding. Oh, it's only 20 days. And Verity's like, no, like, what? It only takes 20 days for how many towns to be attacked. And I think it's really nice to see that even Shrewd, who is wobbly, the good king, is like, eh. People.
I wouldn't say that Shrewd is a good king.
As in good in person or good as in competency or both?
Yep. He's definitely not good personally because, you know, he turns his grandson into a living weapon. And he's not a great king because he's mostly keeping the wheels on the tracks and not rocking the boat, but he's not shrewd enough or decisive enough to take the right courses of action in regards to the Forge. Like, he doesn't make a decision.
That was the point where I think he really dropped the most in my eyes, where it wasn't about him making... And then the book makes a great point about this. It's not about the decision he made. It's that he just wasn't, as you said, shrewd enough to make a decision so people would have clarity. Like, exactly. That's the important thing. In that scenario, you just need to lead rather than necessarily where you're leading.
It's a great bit. And the final season of Star Trek The Next Generation, Beverly and Picard are kidnapped by aliens and they have made to have a sort of technological psychic bond. And Picard, who's a great leader, they're on a deserted planet. Beverly says, which way should we go? And Picard looks around and says, we go that way. And he walks off. And because they're psychically connected, for the first time in the series, Beverly goes, wait, you don't know. You don't know what the right way to lead is. You just made that up. And because the answer is that you just need to have the confidence to make that choice and embrace the consequences.
It's something that, boiled down, I think is a relatively kind of, you know, it's a simple philosophy. I think it does tend to work. Like, making a decision is normally better than just letting things happen.
And it would show a boldness on this part that he doesn't have, and he has a court full of serpents. Like, he has a treacherous son, he has a treacherous wife. It's he's surrounded by serpents and there's nothing he does about it.
It sort of goes, sorry, just going to throw out some life advice, because apparently that's what I use this platform for. It's kind of a key thing that I always kind of recommend to people, is the idea that, like, never don't make, like, there's making the decision not to do something, and then there's just not doing something. It's like applying for a job. Don't not apply because you didn't apply and the deadline passed. Decide, I'm not going to apply. Or decide to apply. Don't just let it not happen. I think that's a real world example which I always like to throw out there.
Thank you, Duncan, for your pearls of wisdom.
You're always welcome. Jordy, I kind of think we've edged back over the Forged again, and I don't think we quite got really down into it. I do just want to knit back in on those people as a character. Jordy, what do you think was going on with the Forged? What's your fan theory?
Oh, man, I don't fucking know. Magic. Magic's happening. Some sort of skilled person has come up with some magical ritual that takes away their compassion.
I think it lines up with everything else we know about the skill. If you can skill into someone, like, psychically impose, you should feel admiration for me, then you should probably be able to do the same by going, you should feel nothing but content and greed for everyone. Go.
Maybe it's something else. I was gently spoiled by exterior forces of this book that dragons exist in this world, and I never mentioned of this book, so clearly there's a lot that we still don't know about.
I didn't know there were dragons.
I didn't know that either. And, like, we didn't even mention, like, the series is called The Elderlings, right? They're mentioned briefly in this book, but then they're never really mentioned again.
Oh gosh, there's so much. And there's such a long series as well. There's so many other books. I'm like, where does this go? How long do we follow Fitz? What I really want to know is, do we get a similar increase in age with Fitz as this trilogy goes on? Or have we caught up to 15 and that's where we're going to sit? Or are we going to keep going into his 20s, up to 30 kind of deal?
All I know, Duncan, is that the picture of him on a certain edition of the next book, he looks like he's probably 20.
Okay. Well, that's either spoiler or really bad artwork. This is not just not a sword.
You've turned against just images of swords now, have you?
I have a bit. I think
I'm
it was
glad.
When it was mostly, to be honest, it isn't even the fantasy books that made me do it. It was the book that I learned from my fan King knowledge from, and what I've praised several times already on this podcast, Unruly by David Mitchell, which also just has like a hammer on it. And I'm like, if a historical book, not historical, just a historical book and a fantasy book can have the same bloody cover, something's gone wrong.
I agree. I think we should have much more stark stylistic covers.
So, like, Poppy War approach. And Brandon said to him, black. No, white.
No. What? Absolutely not. I'm
stark.
Disappointed that that's what you got. Stark doesn't literally mean blank. I mean bold and dynamic.
One thing I always like to point out, I'm never putting I found in a charity shop, like, an old copy of Game of Thrones. And, like, with the classic kind of portraits in the four corners and a picture of, like, the Red Keep. And being like, looking at this, you'd never think this was any different than all the other schlock that was coming out at the time.
We need shit like Empire to Vampire. Like, the just looking at the cover, not only is it bold and beautiful, but it tells you a lot about the book. Like, it tells you that it's big and it's gothic and it's dark and it's, like, kind of beautiful. Great cover. More books should be like that.
Whereas, while I did really like this book, the cover for Assassin's Apprentice told me it was fantasy, maybe in a medievalish setting. I don't know what your copy looks like.
The current cover looks actually a lot like the covers to A Best Served Cold and like the other books in the second part of Joe Abercrombie's sextuple books about
the First Law universe.
Yes. The First Law universe, thank you. Yeah, they're just sort of like parchmenty and E-oldy, and that's it. There are other covers for the series. Like, there's one where he looks like a kid, and then the other one where he looks like a grown adult, but
I think it's quite nicely telling how the main difference between Assassin's Apprentice cover and something like Joe Abercrombie's, like, The Blade Itself cover, the one that I have personally in the UK, is that Joe Abercrombie's is parchment just splattered with a bit of blood. You're like, the difference.
That's a tone indicator right there.
So, Jordy, I feel like we're almost coming to the end. This is a bit sooner than I was expecting. I feel like I've really said my piece.
Well, I'll tell you why, Duncan. It's because so much of his book is about the monotony of his life. It's the slow process of him learning particular lessons. And you can cover that pretty briefly unless you really get stuck into, like, for example, the test Chade gives him to steal something from the king, which is, I think, a really good encapsulation of the book, because the quandary itself is really good, and it goes on for way too long, and it's really emotionally dark, and it just kind of makes me a bit monotonously bored of the overwrought emotions. And at the end of the day, when that's all said and done, I'm not really interested in thinking about anything else, in regards to that scene, at least.
A great example would be, on this reread, the bit when Fritz first gets given over to Galen to be trained in the skill, the psychic powers. There's a good 30 pages which kind of goes on the fact that Galen, he's a hard teacher. You get up at 5 a.m, you eat porridge for breakfast, you get up there on the tower and you start doing your exercises. And this on the reread, I'm not going to lie, Jordy, I kind of flicked through a bit of this.
I'm not surprised.
I knew where it was going and it just went on.
It's sort of like in The Poppy War, like the character of June as a martial arts teacher is similarly harsh and abusive, and the chapters pertaining to his lessons are similarly unjust and make you feel unfair and you feel hurt on the main character's response, and he probably take up about a quarter of as much page count in a much longer book than this.
Oh yes, this book is comparable. I know we said we had a lot to say on Poppy War, do go back and listen to it, but this book still feels like the first part of Poppy War. It really just feels like Fitz is at school. This is the training bit. He's not gone into the world yet. He's not. And I kind of want to see what happens in the future books, because I feel like the next book should be, and my memory's really fuzzy, and I don't think it was straight away, and that was maybe what turned me off. Fitz needs to go on his quest. Like, genuinely, I want it to come down to, okay, Fitz, we need to put over a team together. It's going to be a suicide mission. That's why we're sending you and not anything important, folk. And you're going to go and try and save the world.
Maybe that's why, speaking to someone who has not finished the second book, as someone who has not even started the second book, maybe that's why the third book is called Assassin's Quest. Because she really had to say, listen, this time, I promise, he's going to go and do something.
But it's still beloved by so many people, and I do understand where the emotional resonance comes from in this book, because I had an emotional response, and I've only read this first book. It made me happy when Fitz did well. I felt sorrow and sympathy when things were not going well. I think it, just for me, I felt more connected to some of the other characters, particularly Boric and Patience. We haven't talked too much about, well, we have talked about Patience and like their plights just as much as Fitz. And I do think, Geordie, doing this on a reread and having a little bit more capacity to sort of move my eye over the bits that I thought was going a bit slow, maybe that helped a little. Just a
maybe,
pinch.
Maybe. I will tell you this, Duncan. I'm going to make you a sort of offer similar to what you told me about Green Rider and the books beyond that, which is that I'm going to let you take that next step. If you want to read on the books and tell me, actually, Geordie, they're really good and you should read them, even if not for the podcast, I will listen to you. But I don't think I'm going to quite go out on a limb and read the next book.
I think that's very fair. And actually, I'm glad you brought up Green Rider again, because Green Rider came out, I think, 3 years after this, I think 98.
It's really hard to say why, but there is just something about these books that do remind me of each other. Maybe it's literally just that they came out in a similar era. And there's an oeuvre of the late 90s of fantasy where these books are quite similar.
I will say this, Geordie. Oh, maybe this is going to be a bit controversial. I think I would say that Green Rider was a much more... If I was just recommending to someone came to me like, Duncan, what should I read? I think I'd rather throw Green Rider at someone. It's the same age bracket as well.
Oh, 100%.
This is like a 15-year-old, 100%. Like, I want a fantasy book. I'd be like, take this one. And that's purely off the strength of the first book. And I do get the vibe that this is a series that must grow and expand and go all sorts of directions and keep building that character's emotional complexity. But it's just not quite there for me as like a fun fantasy quest. I feel like I've changed my tune. I think when I started, I was talking about how much I loved this book and was emotionally responsive. But I think I need to like clarify, I felt emotion. Doesn't mean I necessarily had like a fun time.
It's an affecting book, but not necessarily an awesome book.
I think that's well said.
Thank you, Duncan. Duncan, you made the comparison between Green Rider and this book and how you might rank them against each other. And maybe it's time we really double down on that. Maybe it's time we focused in on, we've read a lot of fantasy books together. Which of them do we enjoy? And in what order? I think it's time we assess what are the best books we've read.
Time to do a top 50.
A top 50? We've read 50 books. Let's put them in order.
I'm going to agonize over this.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this a lot as well. I've been going back and forth, shuffling things up and down the list, but I think it's time we did it.
So I think what we're saying, people, if you're listening to this, next time we are not going to be doing a new book for book club. I think next time me and George are just going to sit down and look back over the first 50. I can't believe we've done 50 books. It almost feels like 54 or 55 to me, but maybe they got lost on the editing room floor.
We recently were talking to a friend on a call, and we talked about how we'd started our third year of doing this podcast. And she said, wow, did you two think you'd get this far? And Duncan and I replied the exact same time, yes.
No.
At the exact same time. But yeah, I mean, I always had a strong feeling that no matter how the podcast went, I'd enjoy doing it with Duncan. I do enjoy doing it with Duncan. And I'm really pleased that we've made it this far. I've been thinking ahead to us doing 50 books since the first year of us doing this. So I'm really pleased that we've stuck at it. We've improved along the way, and I'm happy with what we've got so far.
No, I'm immeasurably happy that we got here, even if I'm also immeasurably surprised at the same time. And I can't wait to do this. I can't wait to us to compare. And I also can't wait. We had this idea, and Jordan, I'm going to bring it up now, of like, we could even combine our two lists and have that official, the Is This Just Fantasy rankings.
Yes, we talked about this, and what we're going to do is we'll rank all our books 1 to 50, 1 being the best, and we're going to squish our scores together, and when we average it out, we will have the, as Duncan just said, the official. What is the top 50 books according to Is This Just Fantasy?
What Geordie maybe fails to realise, though, is that in the incredibly unlikely case that we just have like almost inverse lists, everything's going to come out at like position 25.
I have realized that. And I think, I guess we'll end up with a sort of bell curve, right? You know, there'll be a... In the middle, it might get a bit muzzy, but I think you're going to line up overall. I think the extremities will be different, but the middle ground will be strong.
I think that's likely to be the case, and I can't wait to find out what your list is next time. But in the meantime, Geordie, for everyone listening, if you want us to keep going from 50 books to 75 books to 100 books, please do follow us on your podcast app of choice, give us the 5 stars, and then head over to Instagram and follow us there. The best place to get updates and other little tidbits on what we're reading.
And like those, my delicious recipe for the water of life, if you drink it, you will die. If you drink it, you may see.
Well, until then, I've been your host, Duncan Nicol.
And I've been your other host, Geordie Bailey.
Bye.
So long.